Thank you. I wasn't quite sure also whether my talk title changed just a little bit in the last minute. But what I will do is not try to give you an overview of everything related to elliptical galaxies, but I will pick a selection of things where I feel that new results have come out in the last couple of years. And here's just a roadmap. The main part of what I will talk about is indeed what's been new with dynamical properties of nearby elliptical galaxies. And indeed, I'll show you we can now, in fairly sizable samples, make observational statements about the orbital distribution. There are some fairly recent and intriguing things about the kinematics as a function of luminosity, and also show you some new results on, very puzzling results on the transition from luminous to dark matter in elliptical galaxies. And then I will move on to what I find the most exciting development in the last couple of years, namely that it's now possible to do effective dynamical and structural measurements of elliptical galaxies at towards higher redshift, and I will talk about those. Whether I have time to talk about, after the dynamical properties, the global scaling parameters, whether I have time to talk about the population as a whole, I'm not quite sure. All right, so what has been, some of the stuff that has been new in dynamical properties. And a number of groups over the last years have started to really use an application, detailed comparison with data, a modeling technique that Martin Schwarzschild came up with well over 20 years ago. The idea being that you think of galaxies being built up of orbital building blocks, but to skip the technical details, the advantage is that one can finally, what we'd like to get out of the modeling is a statement about the gravitational potential in which the stars orbit and the orbits that they're on. And now one can solve for those two things in a more sensible way simultaneously. And let me just show you from various groups what has happened here, going from somewhat more detailed investigations to statistical results. So the way one goes about it is, if one has an elliptical galaxy here, I have, of course, the disadvantage compared to the spiral talks this morning, that ellipticals look so damn boring that it's not even worth putting up a picture. So envision, if you will, an elliptical galaxy here. You measure the kinematics of the stars along many slits, and then you ask, if I assume something for the potential well, say an isothermal sphere of a certain circular velocity, and calculate what the orbits are, can I combine these orbits so as to match the observations? And that's shown on the right-hand side. Envision each of these columns corresponds to one position angle. Top shows the rotation. Second row shows the velocity dispersion. And the rows beneath higher moments, effectively, a weighted skewness and kurtosis. And indeed, you can make a global model for the orbital distribution, this galaxy, that matches things at all these many position angles. Now, what you then can ask, once I've solved for the orbits that match my observations, what are actually the intrinsic isotropies or anisotropies? And that's what's shown in the next plot. For that solution, you can then go back and ask, for example, along the major axis, what is the ratio of radial motions to tangential motions? And particularly to the vertical motion, and that's shown here, where this parameter beta is zero if the system is isotropic. And indeed, if you assume a logarithmic potential, you find that there is more radial motion along the major axis, it actually doesn't matter too much what you assume for the potential. You can show in this galaxy that is along the major axis, there's everywhere more radial motion. And indeed, one can do Monte Carlo simulations and derive effective error bars. So actually, that is a statement that you should believe for the individual case. I'll show you statistics in a second. This galaxy has a very extended light distribution, no steep cusp. The shallower the light distribution, the harder it is to actually constrain the potential. In this case, I should say this galaxy is a big elliptical that happens to have a gas disk, which gives me the potential and the inclination independent of all the stellar dynamics. So here I actually have a case where I have more information. This is favored over that, but only at the 3 to 5 sigma level. I'll get back to that in a second. So we tried this with simpler spherical models before. Again, what's shown here, the points are the velocity dispersion is a function of radius, the effective radius being here. So now one encloses most of the stellar light, and effectively the kurtosis. What's shown here, this solution again tells you there's about 30% more radial motion than tangential motion. And here a paper from Salia in another big galaxy, that's also the case. So let me show you what this means for the big picture. By now there are about 20 galaxies that have been analyzed, many of them in Andy Kunawitz's thesis, who is a student of Oetting Gerhard. All of these galaxies are galaxies that have effective circular velocities in excess of 250 kilometers a second. And again, isotropic would be here, and virtually all of them are somewhat radially anisotropic. And I'll be curious to hear from Lars in half an hour whether he thinks you would expect that from mergers. At least I support this speculation. Now let's go factor of 10 down in luminosity, because there has been much less work on these smaller ellipticals. Let me describe the following simple experiment that we did years ago. If you go pick a sample of galaxies, all types, between a tenth L star and roughly half L star, actually, and then you throw out all of these galaxies, all the spirals, you throw out all the S0s and anything that everybody who's much better at squinting at these things than I am has ever discerned a disk. So you're left with the subset of objects from all these in the luminosity range, a tenth to half L star, that had a chance to be elliptical, say in the sense of not having a disk. Now, we got very deep kinematics along the major axis, and what's shown here is four. We still looked in other catalogs, three of them, after all, were still classified as zeros, question mark, but never mind. You'll notice they don't look dramatically different from the others. What's shown here is the degree of ordered motion, V over sigma, as a function of radius. And the dotted line in all of them is V over sigma of 1, where rotation starts becoming more important than the velocity dispersion. And the tick marks indicate the effective radius. You notice that except for one object, all those go towards V over sigma of 2 in the outer parts. That is, the majority of the kinetic energy is indeed in rotation. So these are the best objects for having not disk-like kinematics, but they still do. Let me digress for 1 minute here. I'm supposed to talk about the observations, but we tried to figure out whether these things could be remnants of mergers nonetheless. And I also want to make this point that it's worthwhile actually comparing with the observations in detail. So Nicolas Caton and Thorsten Nav in Heidelberg calculated a set of six different 3-to-1 mergers. And what's shown here is, again, V over sigma for the six different cases. And again, the dotted line is this reference mark, V over sigma equals to 1. And at first, you see, both of them come at least in the vicinity of V over sigma of 1. But then, that's not quite fair, because if the observations are right, most of these galaxies have disks, and we would have thrown them out of the sample. So we need to incline our simulations so that they have the same ellipticities as the galaxies we have observed. And then not a single one of these six different merges, which are different orientations, had as much streaming motion over velocity dispersion than the observed galaxies. Well, these are, let's see, Josh Barnes also came up with the six most diverse, right? You do these, you flip them, and you have them at skew angles, right? There's the case where all angular momenta are co-aligned, then you try to, it's basically you have two vectors and you try to space them widely on the sphere. The point I'm trying to make is, indeed, you see, depending on the geometry, what you see here is this, are the kinematics of the surviving main body severely heated by the one-third object, right? And the degree of heating clearly determines on the parameters, but presuming these were, say, random chosen, then at most one-sixth of all mergers can produce that. Okay. Indeed, it seems that even 3-to-1 mergers produce too much random motion. Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, let's just wait what Lars said. Fair enough. I mean, Ortwin Gerhard a long time ago did, I think it actually,
I don't think there's any simulations
that radio orbits or operate somewhere. I know Ortwin has at least one, I know Andy Burkett has one. Some of Josh's do, but not all. So, yep. Let me put it this way. It's indication that these things really don't have a disk, the very big ones. What that means, the semantics of what a merger is. I could spend the rest of the talk on. Fine. So. Let me just mention a couple of things that have to do with luminous and dark matter. Generically, these self-dynamical models, where the constraints are good enough, seem to indicate that the total mass profile goes as r to the minus 2. They're effectively isothermal in the range that encompasses the effective radius. So that's basically the range that has most of the mass. Note that even out here, right, the stellar profile falls off significantly faster than r to minus 2. But it's also, now there are more and more cases where one can use the gravitational lensing to ask in detail what the mass profile is. Basically, let me just show you here a simple sequence of pictures of a gravitational lens system. You have the intervening big galaxy sitting here, double images of the background source. And what lensing really does is it measures the mass projected in a cylinder of roughly this diameter. And if you can measure, and this is now becoming increasingly more possible, the velocity dispersion of this galaxy, it measures the mass in the sphere. So you can compare those two. Clearly, the projection effects depend on the radial mass profile. And if you do this, you find that things match by far best if you assume an r to the minus 2 total mass profile. So I just want to mention these two things. And finally, slowly, both with the best now reanalyzed ROSAT data and ASCA results. There are now slowly more and more X-ray results that really cover the relevant range from even inside an effective radius. And what's shown here is, after you model this, the best total mass profile, believe or don't believe the decomposition in the various components, but even the X-rays really say that there's no feature in the rotation curve in the transition from luminous matter domination to dark matter domination. The final thing on luminous and dark matter is something that I find very puzzling, namely what this modeling does for you. All the dynamical modeling effectively gives you a solid way of estimating what the circular velocity is in these galaxies, which allows you to effectively do a Tully Fisher relation for ellipticals. We did this for its zeros 2 years ago, and Andy Grunewetter has added basically all of his set. And now, first of all, there is a relation, but that's not the interesting part. The weird thing is, I didn't draw this in here, but if you ask, at a given circular velocity, how bright are the galaxies? The ellipticals are just as bright within less than half a magnitude, about 0.3, than the spirals. So the total mass-to-light ratio inside the radial regime that you probe is the same for spirals and ellipticals. And
At B.
Thank you. Yeah, makes things even worse, right? The old population and the fact that GM over R should, where R is smaller in the ellipticals, makes things worse. The only way out, at least qualitatively, is, since we know the stellar mass to light ratios ought to be different, is that we have a significantly larger portion of dark matter in the spirals than in the ellipticals. Okay, let me now come to the second part, namely the global scaling relations, which are for the first time really a means to allow us to track the mass-to-light ratio evolution of ellipticals as a function of redshift. I just want to very quickly flash some of the beautiful results that Peter van Dokkum has gotten. I think he may talk about them more extensively tomorrow. The idea is, right, if you combine velocity dispersion, effective surface brightness, and size in just the right way, you get the fundamental plane. And if you go to a distant cluster, this plane is offset. And the use in this context is indeed that, depending on, since stellar populations first fade faster and slower, this allows you to put a constraint on the formation epoch of these systems. And basically, it also, since stellar physics happens in real years, not in Z, right? It also depends on the cosmology. But the upshot is, for this extreme cosmology in terms of total age of the universe, you have to have formed basically all the stars at a ratio of 2 or higher. Now, a possible criticism you might apply is, well, these things are referred to the reddest galaxies in the richest cluster at that epoch, which is, so it is a true statement, but it refers to an ever-decreasing fraction of the total galaxy population. So one of the things, pardon me? The gray line, I'm sorry, I should have said, is formation at infinity. So this is correct. So in a right, in Omega is one universe that is just too old for anything, you can just make it a very high redshift formation. And here, I should have said, this pair of open lines refers to a redshift formation at 2. So now, lensing can also. That is the best single age population fit is a redshift. And mind you, this refers to the stellar content, not to possible subsequent assembly, right? This is really a mass to light ratio measurement. Well, so what we did in order to attempt to remedy this strong environment selection is we said, fine, we now have these nice images of the lenses, which I've just shown you. They allow us, they're resolved, we can measure the effective size. We see their brightness, and the image separation is proportionate to the mass enclosed. So we have a measurement of the mass. So we can again take all of our lenses and place them effectively on the fundamental plane and measure their mass to light ratio. Now this is a very different selection because all of these lens systems were found without ever seeing the galaxy. So now you have a mass selected sample of potential wells, and they actually, some are in clusters, some are in the field, some are in small groups. They're selected to be very massive and very dense. And then we ask, well, what are the age distributions of their stellar populations? And this is summarized in this plot. What's effectively shown here is how does their luminosity differ from local ellipticals as a function of redshift in the VI and H band. And so lenses go from 0 to 1, effectively the lenses we have in our sample. And again, we can ask for what star formation histories is this consistent? And what's shown here, the dashed line is the silly olden times, no evolution line, no time has gone by. We don't want to be that extreme. But then, what are different cosmologies shown here? These are star formation at basically infinity, then all the way down to star formation at redshift 1. And this is the expected evolution in the V-band. So note, say for omega 0.3, the V-band follows the predictions of the lowest line, roughly lowest two lines, which is formation at either redshift 3 or 10, the same way in the I-band, same way H-band. And only if we again take the omega 0.3 lambda 0.7 model, you actually see that you might end up with a formation of the stars, or the best single age interpretation of the stellar population between redshifts 2 and 3. So the upshot is, for those galaxies selected in a very different fashion, you get exactly the same answer you get as for a cluster sample. And 5 minutes? Okay, then I just want to say or mention two things that, two results that we've been working on recently on the question of evolution of the population. I think that'll be discussed in much more detail also tomorrow. Of course, once you go to high redshift, the definition of what you mean by an elliptical becomes trickier and trickier. You can, for example, say, a galaxy whose spectral energy distribution is at least as red as, you know, an ES0, SA, whatever. And then you can ask, how does the co-moving density of these early type by SCD selected galaxies evolve? And there was, well, some discussion between the results from CNOC and CFRS. I just want to show that a group in Heidelberg has been doing a redshift, effectively low-resolution spectroscopic redshift survey by using 18 filters for 3,000 galaxies between 0 and 1. We have now enough galaxies to really peel out the red sample and ask how does the luminosity function evolve from lowest redshift being 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, and basically 0.85. And this is for an omega equals 1 universe. It doesn't evolve at all. But that's just a statement about the luminosity function. This is the rest frame absolute B magnitude with no evolution corrections. That is correct. Because I couldn't put an evolution correction on there that did not evolve 10 questions out of the audience, right? That is exactly right. So, indeed, it is the same as CFRS. We actually, and it's a separate story, this survey is deep enough that you can kind of see the Magellanic Cloud at redshift 0.7, 0.8. So, it's also the same at a fainter level. Right, and let me skip the question of red galaxies at high redshift. I think Amy Varga will talk about this. It's clear that at any redshift that you look, if you look in the infrared, if you look the right way, you will find galaxies whose populations seem to be as old as the age of the universe. You know, whether these are necessarily the things that will end up being ellipticals is a separate question. So, just to summarize, on dynamics, I'm showing you for the very luminous ones, the orbits are radially anisotropic. That's just derived back from the observations. For the low luminosity ones, I apologize, low luminosity ones, they have very much rotation. And if I say elliptical halos are dense, then that statement refers to the rotation curves in ellipticals are flat from the luminous to the dark matter dominated part. Since the luminous parts are 50 times denser than in spirals, the halos in some sense have to be correspondingly dense. And with the global scaling relations, how they evolve with redshift, I think, you know, there are several techniques now that show for subsets that the mass-light ratio evolves as slow as physically possible. And I think we've reached a stage that now we actually have tools, and you'll hear more about this tomorrow, to measure the mass-light ratios, even for sizable samples. And it's now really that one has to pay even more attention to exactly how you pick out the galaxies whose mass-to-light ratio you measure before you compare them to models. Thank you.
It wasn't quite clear from your diagrams, maybe it's said on them, but did you find that for the bright ellipticals, the velocity distribution was isotropic in the center and then became progressively more radial?
Most of them become more isotropic towards the center.
So if you were going to quantify that in terms of an anisotropy radius, quantity RA that some...
I would, if I had to give a ballpark number, and there's variation amongst the objects, it is in the vicinity of a tenth of an effective radius. Inside of that, they become progressively more isotropic. But
can? So there's a very little mass that's in this isotropic part.
Yeah, so I think the values that I showed you here from Andy Gunovit, that this distribution was luminosity weighted over the accessible radii. So indeed, the isotropic core contains a small fraction of the total mass.
Question about the selection of the galaxies that you used to look at the Yo sigma distribution of radius, because even if these systems have Yo sigma of 2, you don't expect that we have 6 of those galaxies. They all have Yo sigma projected of 2. So it seems that you have somehow...
I didn't expect the result, right?
Yeah.
No, all I can say is it's clearly bears repeating the experiment with... I used photometric pre-selection to increase my chances for them not to be rapid rotators.
You did not select against disky isotropes, right? You only selected against someone having made a classification that involved some disk something.
Yeah.
So they do have disky isotropes, because most of these things do.
Not terribly disky, and I can tell you why. Because my interpretation would be they have fairly strong disks. If they were edge-on, you'd see them, so they have to be kind of face-on in order to hide the disk, and then they don't have disky isotropes anymore. I think they are just... It's just the face-on half of the S0 population. And it isn't really a diskless population of any significance in that luminosity range.
We have quite a few questions, but since we have half an hour of discussion at the end of the session, let me have only two more questions. One for Rosie and one for Simon.
I was just wanting to clarify some of the discussion that we heard on the first part of your talk. Can I interpret your observations as saying that all ellipticals form by a collapse, but with the amount of dissipation in that collapse smoothly varying as a function of the luminosity, so that it's higher for low luminosity ellipticals?
I don't know whether I would give an endorsement of this statement, but let me just clarify a few things. I don't think there are...
Can you contradict that statement?
I'll just retreat to the things that are measured. Very rapid rotation at the low luminosity end and radial anisotropy at the high end. I don't think these are distinct classes. I think this is just a rapid transition of the different ingredients as a function of luminosity.
Could you just put up your Caddis luminosity functions again? It seemed to me it had a very strong result there, which went by rather quickly, might not have been noticed. So if you compare your lowest redshift, which is 0.1 to 0.3, and your highest redshift, which is 0.7 to 1, they seem more or less to coincide at L star.
Right.
Whereas in Respirane B, between those two redshifts, the evolution, the aging of a normal stellar population would predict more than a factor of 2 change, which is not seen. So this, although those lines on top, a simple interpretation would then require you to have a strong evolution between those two redshifts.
I hope it was clear that it said there's no evolution in the luminosity function, which is the statistical measure, not... I remember you asking, making the same comment when Simon Lilly showed the first CFRS results. Yeah, I don't think that means that the galaxies didn't...
So this is actually inconsistent with all the galaxies being there and just aging along the time.
That is correct.
However, there is a result by the Propries and Stanford and others in which they show that the K's in the K band, the K star does not evolve. I mean, evolves is consistent with pure passive evolution all the way to red one.
In clusters, this is an I band selected sample in the field. So.